Hey, before we dive in, I just want to talk to you about something. You know, I recently hired an intern, which, you know, huge power trip. But I got to tell you, it was a pain in the butt to find this person. I had to talk with a couple different schools. I had to fill out a whole bunch of applications. I had to go through a ton of candidates to find someone who I thought was really great. And by the way, shout out to Kaylee Raglan, who's been absolutely crushing it for me. She's doing an unbelievable job. But, you know, it took a lot of time to find her. And what I should have done is I should have just gone to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply for your job. ZipRecruiter makes hiring efficient and effective with features like screening questions to filter candidates and an all-in-one dashboard where you can review and rate your candidates. So you got to do this. You got to go to ZipRecruiter.com. And I'm going to give you a little tip because it's going to make me look good here. Go to www.ZipRecruiter.com/Zach. That's my name, Z-A-K. Make sure you spell it correctly. And check it out. If you need to hire someone, if you're looking to bring someone on board, don't waste time doing the usual recruiting nonsense. Go to ZipRecruiter.com and get the job done there. Okay, I'm done talking. I've talked way too long. Let's go. Here we go. Let's dive in.
The Zach Kuhn Show.
Episode 45. This is a big one. Today's guest is Clarence Spaulding. He is the head of Maverick in Nashville and manages acts like Jason Aldean, Reba, Brooks and Dunn, Darius Rucker, and others. I do a big introduction, but I don't really know how to make this episode sound any cooler than it already is. So I think we just have to dive in. Here we go. Let's dive in.
Is this the this is the Maverick headquarters right here? Is this where I'm looking?
Yeah, this is it. It's where all the shit goes down.
This is where the shit goes down. Is that Keith Richards behind you?
Yeah, that's about that in Los Angeles at the Morrison Gallery. I got this. I don't know if you can see this one. That's my Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash? How cool is that?
I bought those. Bought those two at the same day. So, my two pieces of art in my office.
That is awesome. Are you a big Stones fan?
Yeah, I'm a big Stones fan. I've probably seen them 4 or 5 times. I think they're they're interesting to me, and you know the music, obviously I grew up on it, but more of the creative that goes into those shows. And some of my friends have done the creative that I've used on some of my Brooks and Dunn tours through the years, and you know they told stories. And there's a great DVD set of the Stones doing a theater, and then they do a building in, I think, a Toronto, and then they do an outdoor stadium, and it's all of the workings that go in to putting those shows together. And about once a year, I'll watch that, and it just, you know, kind of gives you a little bit puts the excitement back into you for, you know, trying to put shows together year after year after year after year, and you know, just everything that goes into that. And so
I kind of feel similar, that sometimes if you're trying to tap into that original feeling of excitement with music, or kind of like why you're doing this in the first place, the Stones are a band that I'll go to that will do that for me. They just excite me. Anytime I watch like a live video or anything, they just blow my mind how cool they are. And
there's a great scene in there. Their production manager was a guy named Jake Berry. And you know, he's one of those production guys that everybody in the business has heard of, Jake Berry. And I think they're in Canada, but they are Mick and another Stone, I can't remember which one, are standing at House Mix, and they're looking at all of their stuff, and they have the floor painted, and it's all of these lines. And Mick looks at Mark Fisher, who was one of the set designers, And he just basically says, I know it was my idea, but I fucking hate it. And it just rings so true that through the years, you know, we've all sat back at House Mix and looked at stuff that we just loved, you know, conceptually. Then when we saw it, it was like, that was a terrible idea. And but the next day they have Jake and two or three other guys in overalls, and they're painting the floor, the deck. And Jake looks at the camera and said, "Thank God it wasn't the day of the show."
they're fixing it. He gets whatever he wants. I love in the Martin Scorsese movie at the Beacon, that was shot, I think, in 2002. I love how in the beginning Martin's begging them for the set list. He's like, "I need the set list. Like, I want to know what these shots are going to be." And they're like, "We'll get you the set list. We'll get it to you." And then the last second, someone runs into the office and says, "We got the set list." And he says, "Okay, first song is," and the band starts.
It's crazy. Yeah. So that's my connection to the Stones.
I love it. So let me ask you this, because I've heard this story about your very first night on the road with Brooks and Dunn. And did they leave you behind with the bus? What's the story about the first night
they get
with Brooks and Dunn?
They get a big kick out telling that story, you know. It wasn't the first night, but it was the first week. And Kix and Ronnie, I jumped up on the bus with them, and they were in the back lounge playing video games. And I said, "Hey, you guys want a beer?" And yeah, we'll take a beer. And go up to the front, and there's no beer. So I run into the catering to get beer. And when I come back, no bus. I can see the bus over on the horizon. And so I get on the radio and I'm yelling, I'm pissed off. And I'm like, you know, this is the most fucked up situation I've ever been in. And so I had to get a runner to run me to the bus. And, you know, they just howled laughing. And you know, I was the new guy. So, you know, it wouldn't have been my normal, you know, jumping up somebody's ass, but so they kicks especially gets a huge, you know, rise out of telling that story, how they left me on the first night.
And yet you didn't leave them, you stuck with them.
Hell no, I wasn't leaving them. I mean, I had left a great job to come over and work with them, and you know, they were starting to hit on all cylinders.
How did Bob pull you in? How did you and Bob Tidley connect?
It's a crazy story that I was working for Stan Maress, and Stan had, you know, Eddie Rabbit and KT Oslin and Laurie Morgan and Clint Black and Roger Miller and Don Williams and Ronnie Millsap. And we had 13 acts at one time. And I had come off the road with Exile, and I'd actually met Stan through Exile's manager, Jim Morey. And you know, just one thing led to another. And finally, I got off the road with Exile and went to work for Stan. And that's how I met Bob, through Stan, through the years I was working with Stan. But a mutual friend of ours had called me and said, "Bob is looking for somebody to help with Brooks and Dunn." And I sent him two or three guys. I mean, I sent him people, you know. So, you know, I didn't think anything about it. I pick up the phone and call so-and-so and go, "Hey, Titley's looking for somebody for Brooks and Dunn." I guess all of them got the interview. And one guy that I'd sent over, I don't know that he would have worked out, but he almost got hired. He just wanted too much money. And he was working for another big act, and he just wanted more money and then Bob was going to pay. And so when my mutual friend called me back and he said, "Man, Titley's still looking for somebody." And I was like, "Jesus, what the fuck is he looking for anyway? You know, I've sent him." And he said, "Well, he's looking for you." He said, "But he doesn't want to, you know, snatch from Stan." And I said, "Well, I'm going to talk to Stan. I'm going to talk to him." So I went and told Stan, "Some, you know, Titley's looking for somebody. I'm going to go talk to him. And I did. And we, you know, Bob is, you know, Bob?
Not personally, no.
Well, you know, he's, I say this all the time when people ask me about him. He's 10 times smarter than I will ever be. And, you know, he's just highly, highly intelligent and a genuinely good guy. So he offsets me, you know, I'm emotional and, you know, I go into his office with a problem and, you know, he goes, well, you know, walk me through it. And I walk him through it. And he goes, have you ever thought of it this way? And I'm going, well, fuck no, I didn't think of it that way. I'm too emotional to think of it. So, we structure a deal and I start, you know, is 1993.
But you said to him, I'm going to be here for 3 years. And if this is still working out, I want to be partner.
Where'd you find that out?
Look, I've got a great research team, Clarence.
Well, it did. I was working for Stan and I had, you know, I made my mind up that I thought I could do this. You know, when you come off the road, you're not sure, you just, you know, I'm working for a big company with big acts, but I find my footing at Stan's, and Stan was a great mentor. And so I really felt like I could do it. And so when I went, I told Bob, I said, listen, I'll do it for 3 years with you. If at the end of 3 years, I'm not a partner, it's okay. I'm leaving. I'm not, I will not try to take anybody with me, but I'm going to go out on my own. And 3 years later, he made me a partner. So, you know, he held up his end of the deal and we were partners for 10 years, or we were involved together for 10 years. Basically, Bob decided he didn't want to do it anymore. I mean, it was just, I don't know if he'd lost interest, he'd lost focus, but he just decided that, you know, I just don't want to do this. And so I left, I moved up the street and Kicks and Ronnie, whoever else I had at the time, came with me and started Spalding Entertainment. And that was...
Does that take like a little bit of tenacity to go up to this guy who's a little more, you know, wise or been around maybe a little longer and just say, hey, I'm giving you 3 years and then I want to be your equal?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's more probably stupidity, but it's... I didn't say it that way.
Right, of course. Yeah.
It was more of, you know, I knew he would understand, you know, if you have a vision of one day having your own thing, then you can't go to work for somebody and just work for them the rest of your life. You've got to figure out how do I get out on my own? And the only way that I know to do that is to put a stop date. You know, you end up being like a carton of milk. You know, sooner or later, the expiration date comes and you start smelling bad. Well, in my case, it's where you're unhappy because you're working for someone else.
Right.
And it's not fair to either party. It's not fair to the acts you manage. It's just one of those things that, you know, you get to a point in your life, in your career, and you go, and I need to have my own shop. So it worked out, you know, it worked out, you know, nobody went away mad at each other. There wasn't any, you know, he took this or I had never heard, you know, Bob saying a negative thing about me, and nor will anybody ever hear me say a negative thing about him. It was a good relationship that came to an end.
Is that the feeling also at Maverick? I mean, I feel like my sense is that you're very much your own boss, even within Maverick, but is that a similar feeling, or is that a balance that you had to, you know, that the benefits of it? Or?
I think that's everybody in Maverick, you know, that's how that came together was when Mike Rapino called me and asked me if I knew who Guy O'Siri was. And I said, I've never met him. But I, you know, I know who he is. He said, well, he wants to talk to you about an idea he has, but, and it's up to you. You know, I'm not going to tell you, have to do it or you should do it. I'm just going to make the introduction. So I talked to Guy the next day or so, and he was telling me about his idea to bring in, you know, a group of managers. We share no monies. It's all about sharing knowledge and ideas, and I love that idea. And I, at the time, Randy Goodman was working with me. He had come out of Lyric Street, and he was working with me. And so I flew myself and he and Chris Parr, who's been doing Jason since the beginning, flew them to LA, and we met with Guy. And because I felt like, you know, I'm going to make this move. You know, I want my team to be a part of it and to support it. And by the way, if it's, you know, if it's not a great idea, I want somebody to say, shake me and go, you know, what the fuck are you thinking? And so we met with Guy, and the meeting was good. And I got back in the car and I said, okay, somebody tell me why we shouldn't do this. And both of them were like, you know, there's no reason not to do this. This is going to make all of us better managers. And, you know, by the way, it doesn't cost us anything. So, and that's what, you know, has gone down.
Hey everyone, hope you're enjoying the episode. I want to let you know about a newsletter that I run called the Nashville Briefing. It really takes you to the front lines of everything happening in Music City and the music industry at large. So if you want to subscribe and be in the know, go to nashvillebriefing.com to check it out. Okay, let's get back to the program.
So what's this story about how at the top of the pandemic, is it true that, you know, you're on the television committee, CMA's Joe Galante. Is it true that at the top of the pandemic, does Robert Dean call you and he says, look, I don't think we're going to be able to do the award show, you know, the way we normally do it. We've got to find another way to do it. Does he call you that early on to try to figure out a way to put it together?
To be honest with you, I don't know. At the top of the pandemic, we were really, truly, the award shows, Christmas show, they were on our mind, but really the music fest was the most pressing issue, because I think I started moving stuff around in regard to the pandemic. I had Reba in dress rehearsals, and, you know, I'm on the phone with doctors of going, okay, let's walk through this. What, you know, give me best practices, because I'm on the road. I mean, I have no idea that it's going to shut down the world.
Do you still go out on the road? Are you still out with your artists? Like, will you get on a bus and sleep on a bunk?
I will, but I hate it.
Why do you do that? Does it all fall apart? I'm sure there's a great tour manager.
Oh, hell no. They don't miss me at all. Most of the time they look at me like, what are you doing out here? No.
Yeah, why do you go out on the road? What's the...
Well, I think it's a good, healthy relationship for a manager to go out there. I'm normally I go, I mean, you got to remember it takes a long time to get a show together, right? I mean, you just don't click your heels and, you know, all of a sudden the wizard appears. It's you're in set normally. So this is December. We would have started in July designing a set, going through the you know, the research and development of this set. It's gonna, where's it, how many venues is it going to fit in, is it going to fit, do I like to have ABC look of the same set, so if I go into a smaller venue I don't have to give up the whole show. So that's a little bit of Stones stuff there,
right?
But you know, it takes such a long time to develop it. And then, so, you know, we're in the midst of that. Now in December, we would be either rehearsing, probably at SIR or Nashville Cartage or somewhere, the show, not the lighting and the band, the
performance set of it, basically.
This would be music we would be working on. And then we would go to a bigger place, Nashville Arena, couple of other places in town where we can hang the lights and hang the sound and do the show. We would do it. We load it in, load it out. There's a dance to that of how many trucks is it going to fit in? We don't know. How's the pack going to be?
Right.
And then we, in Reba's case, we were doing all that and we were getting ready to go to Evansville. and to do 2 days of dress rehearsal in Evansville and then do a show. And then we were going to pack it up and take it to the next city. So when COVID started, you know, we're looking at best practices, but all of a sudden it becomes obvious that we're not doing the first shows. We're not doing the second shows. And Reba's tour is going away in that I was moving it to July of this past year, you know, thinking,
We'll be on in July.
No way it'll last this long. And it didn't take very long, I think, until maybe beginning of April. And, you know, you're looking at this going, hey, this is going to be way worse than anybody's thought it's going to be. So we picked up all the Reba dates, all the Brooks and Dunn dates, all of the Jason Aldean dates, and moved them to the same time in 21. You know, not being, we weren't definitely going to be in the first part of the year in 21. We didn't have vaccine on our mind. We were just going, if this thing gets up and going, it's not going to be going in the winter. Okay, that, or if it is, I don't want a chance having to move things three times. You know, it's not fair to the consumer. So we picked it up and we moved it. That in March and April, we're looking at Music Fest. How can we do? You know, and it's meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. And, you know, through, you run all of the scenarios, A, B, C, D. A would be, we get to do the show. B is, we move it from the football stadium to Ascend and maybe one other place. You know, C is this, and D is, hey, we're going to do a best of show. And that's what we ended up doing. Where that went in the pecking order, I can't remember, but it wasn't A or B. So as we're working through that, you know, Robert and his team are working through every scenario of where can we do these shows after this, and then you plug those in, and you have to plug in COVID, all of the, you know, different regulations that come down through the different unions after a SAG. How many tests does everybody have to have? And there's a huge cost associated with that. So we did the Christmas show out at Citation, which is a large studio west of town. And then we learned a lot from that in regard to COVID. What we could do, how long it was going to take to test, you know, just mind-boggling the amount of people. Well, when you're thinking of the award show, you take the number of people who are working on the Christmas show and throw a big multiplier on that. You know, just so many days of being in the venue prior to the show. How are we going to do rehearsals? You know, who can be there based on the rules and regulations of the health department? So just, you know, just a lot of thought. And I think that, you know, I've said this before, but Sarah Trahearn and Robert and their teams just did a magnificent job to be able to put that on. And, you know, inside that night, we placed everybody like you would in a big restaurant. I think we had, the health department gave us a number of right around 100 people that we could have sitting, and everybody else had a face mask and a plastic shield on anytime. We called that zone A. Anytime you were anywhere near an artist in that area, you had to wear that. And that was, they had people inside making sure that, you know, Clarence Spalding didn't get on his phone and pull his mask down or whatever. It was good. You know, everybody felt safe.
Yeah, I remember talking with Robert very early on in the pandemic, and he said the CMAs will not work remotely. He said part of the CMAs is the reaction of the people in the room and capturing the feeling in the room. And then when I was watching that show, I understood what he meant by that, because you would see the artists kind of celebrating with each other, and that makes it look really special.
Yeah, you know, just a odd time. You know, you're in there and you're looking around, which you don't get to see, but they're looking around, seeing Robert and I with our face mask and our shield on over here. And, you know, it's nowhere near the normal show where we're running around and there's a lot of socializing going on. Not so much this year.
Right, of course. So you're the guy who really has a reputation of either taking big acts and making them even bigger, or taking, you know, younger acts and blowing them up into superstars, and then you keep them on top, like Jason Aldean, perfect example. Right now, during COVID, when everything's kind of upside down, how do you think about keeping your acts on top and front of mind? Or are some of your acts so big that they can afford to kind of go away for this year and come back and still be on top?
Well, I just want my acts to remain relevant during this time. In different acts, it's not one size fits all. You know, with the CMAs coming around or the ACMs coming around, you know, you're looking at your acts and going, what song would we do? Does it mean anything? You know, you can go on TV, and I've made this mistake lots of times of putting an act on a show with a half-assed song, and it just not being a moment. So you're trying to position your artist, and, you know, they have a big say in that.
Is it better to not have them on the show?
I think so. A lot of people disagree with me, and that's, you come up in the business, managers, agents, but particularly the acts, and they've been watching these shows their entire life, and they want to be on that show. And the time comes, they want their shot at the show. But a lot of times you just have a mediocre song. Just fucking mediocrity. You know, it's not bad, it's not good, it's mediocre. And that's my single right now. And so I think that the best thing you can do is pass, you know, or find something else, you know, find something else that means something. Back in the day, you know, in Kix and Ronnie, and we, you know, so we went through periods where we had songs that were just, they're going to be around forever.
Of course.
And then we had songs that weren't around for 30 seconds, or they shouldn't have been. So just, you know, just like I said, okay songs. And I remember fighting for a song to go on the CMAs one year. And it was just a piece of shit. Yeah, but we wanted to be on the show. You know, that was our thing. And then I can remember standing and watching that song going, shouldn't have done that. Should have just passed on the whole damn thing. You know, nobody would have missed you. Nobody's going to remember this song, but you just took up a slot that, you know, somebody else could have had. So try to look at it more that way now. I'm not always successful. And
you're not more competitive that, you know, you're like, someone else could have had that slot, but then isn't that a slot you don't have? Like, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but, you know, how am I using the slot? Just to show my act as a half-ass act, you know, by doing a half-ass song. Those are the moments when you try to pull back. Not, you know, I don't want to say Clarence is this genius. He's not. It's you pull your team together and go, okay, what can we do different? Sometimes you can shine it up a little bit by adding an element to it. You add somebody to the song that nobody's expecting to be on that song. Or, you know, in our case with Reba and Darius, we were going to do, Reba was going to do one of her big hits, but she was really good friends with Mike Davis. So months prior, Reba had been to Mike's house and Mike had been pitching songs for her new album. And Reba called me and said, you know, Mike pitched me some songs, and but gosh, In the Ghetto. She said, that song just kills me. She said, what do you think about me doing it? And I said, you know, you'd be one of, I don't know how many people who have covered that song, blah, blah, blah. And but so we pushed that conversation off to the side. She had a end title track, which will come out next year, to a movie that we were going to cut. We were going to cut it with Tony Brown. And at the night before, the production company for the film and the label couldn't agree on the usage. So I got a phone call saying, look, we're going to do this song, but we don't want you to do it tomorrow. So we had Tony, we had a studio, we had musicians. We're going to have to pay everybody anyway. So I called Reba and I said, is there something you want to do? And she said, what about In the Ghetto? I said, perfect. She said, you think Darius would want to do it with me? I said, oh, hell yes. So, and that was just pure luck. I mean, just pure luck. And so they go in and cut the song. And when, and still we were going to do one of Reba's hits on the show. In the Ghetto was going to appear on an album and sometime in the future. And Mike passes away. They're going to do a tribute to him on the show. And Reba says, I don't want to do my song. I want to do In the Ghetto. And so that's what we did. So
it was a great performance.
Yeah, it was, it was one of those moments in a show, you know, when Robert and I and Joe, Sarah talk about, you see the board that Robert's put together. So it'll go from act one, two, three, it's all index cards. And when you're looking at the board, the question always is, where are the moments? I can see the mediocrity. I can see that song that's, you know, they have to do whatever, but where are our moments in this show?
Right.
And Robert's always he's either able to point them out or go, I have a couple of great ideas that I'm going to pitch to someone. And if they do it, I think we'll have two more moments in the show.
Right. And we want the biggest moments to cross the first hour or the second hour.
You want the, you know, the biggest acts that are going to hold an audience. But, you know, you got to remember, Zach doesn't know a moment is coming up. He knows Carrie Underwood's coming up, and he's a Carrie Underwood fan, and he's going to stick with it. And then she does something, you go, holy shit. That was a fantastic performance, right? I mean, nobody, okay, knew that Chris Stapleton and Justin Timberlake, they weren't going, this is a moment coming up, right? Nobody, anybody says that's a liar. That's just one of those moments that, boom, there it was, and the rest is history, right?
It's not really a moment if you know that's coming up.
You know, just one of those things where you go, I mean, I can look back in my career and I remember Tim McGraw doing, I just lost it, Live Like You Were Dying. And it was just a pure white background. He did it at the ACMs. And I knew that song, but he came out and did it. And it was like, whoa. You know, Alan doing Where Were You, Kix and Ronnie doing Believe in New York. I mean, they're just times when you just remember those big songs. And there's plenty of them, you know, through the history of these award shows that you just go, those are the ones I really remember.
Right. But how do you keep someone like Jason Aldean, like you said earlier, you want to keep him front of mind? Does that mean you have him playing the late night shows and he's on Fallon and he's doing certain things? Like what how do you think about that?
I don't think about it a lot. I mean, to be honest with you, I think that when we have something is when we need, it's like doing the shows. I mean, to go on there just to do something.
It's not worth it.
There's no impact. I mean, there's three late night shows. There's a late night show. There's three morning shows. I mean, there was a day when country music was the stepchild, and for us to get on anything was tough. I mean, it was just, we had our two award shows. You fought to get on those, but you just weren't, it wasn't a given you were going to be on Letterman. It wasn't a given that you were going to be on whatever that was at that particular time, or the morning shows. Now we're more like pop music. You know, everybody's familiar with Jason. Everybody's familiar with Luke. Everybody's familiar with Marin, blah, 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 you know. So we can be, you can be overexposed. You can be that person that's everywhere with nothing. And I think that's where people kind of tune you out. They look at it and go, he never has anything to say. She never has anything to say. And click, 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 and they move on. And you try as best you can to position your artist in a way that people want to listen to them, that they're talking about something they haven't heard before. They're listening to a song that maybe they've heard before, but it's a hit and they want to hear it. Or they're, you know, it's just something unique that they're talking about, singing about, that makes the viewer want to stick with us.
Absolutely. So I love this story of, you know, you sign Jason Aldean, you start working with Jason Aldean, and he signed to this independent label, Broken Bow, created by a car salesman from the West Coast, Benny Brown, and his deal comes up for renegotiation, and everybody thinks you're going to sign with a major, and Jason says, no, I want to stay with Broken Bow, and you resign with Broken Bow. What was it about this kind of indie venture, new label, startup that gave you the confidence to stick with them? What did they have that convinced you guys to stay along?
They had Jason Aldean.
And
Benny Brown had the vision to sign Jason Aldean. And Benny was, he was a successful businessman. I don't want to demean him. He had to learn the business. What we do is not rocket science. We're not curing cancer over here. So if you got about a half a fucking brain, you know, you can pick up the business, right? And Benny believed in Jason. Jason was 2 days away from going back to Macon.
Pepsi Cola truck.
So he offers him the deal, and they work their butts off, and Benny works his butt off, and everything clicks. And so when it came time to look for other deals, you sit down with your artist and go, what do you think? He goes, I want to stay at Broken Bow as long as it's, I'm getting a good deal. And so we never shopped it. We got phone calls here from people going, hey, I know Jason's deal's coming up. And I just told my staff, we don't talk to anybody about this. That was the promise we made to Benny. And I'm not going to go against it. He has the opportunity to re-sign Jason. And if he hits the number in the deal, we move on. And that's basically what happened. Jason, I'm like all my artists, but he's very, very loyal. And maybe some other artists would have gone, let's go out and test the waters everywhere else and see what we can get. That's a great stroke of the ego, right? I mean, everybody wants you. Everybody wants to pay you all this money and give you this, and we'll give you your own label, and we'll give you, and we'll give you, and we'll give you. But in his case, he wasn't, interested in that. It was more of, I want to do the right thing by Broken Bow and Benny Brown. And if they do the right thing by me, we'll all be together.
Right. How important is the right, like when you're trying to find the right label for an artist, will you think about terms for what you're looking for and then shop that around? or is it a gut thing? Or how important is it to match the right artist with, you know, the right label or the right type of deal? Or how do you assess that?
Well, you know, it's different artists at different stages of their career demand different deals. And in the beginning, it's not a lot of demanding going on. It's a lot of what can we get, you know? So what you're really trying to find is passion. You know, who are the ones who have the most passion for the project? And then you're looking at the teams. You know, here, you know, when I first came to town, I forget if there was probably 20 labels. I mean, it was labels everywhere. And radio wasn't the same, you know, playlists were bigger and it was just a different day. And now, you know, you have 5, 6, you know, number of majors where we've all come up in the business together. When you look at, you know, I'm looking at rosters, who has something that might look a little bit like this that might get in my way. But other than that, I'm just looking for the team and the passion for the project. And then, you know, I sit down with the artist and it's not my decision. You know, I'm here to advise. So I, you know, you want to know what they feel good about. Who do they feel good about? You know, who are they going to work their ass off for? And
right. How does Irving Azoff convince you to team up with him?
Irving can convince anybody of anything for the fucking record. that's not a hard thing for Irving to do. You know, he's Irving Azoff. And so when Irving called, I hadn't been away from Bob very long. I mean, Spalding Entertainment was not, you know, we were Brooks and Dunn and maybe Shelley Wright and maybe something else. I can't even remember, but it was Brooks and Dunn. So he called and he and Howard Kaufman were going to, you know, they had a company they started in the beginning called Frontline.
Right.
And it was Howard Kaufman. It was Irving Azoff. Through the years, you know, they were the baddest ass managers in the world. Still are, to
a big degree.
Howard's passed away, but Irving's still the baddest ass manager in the world. And so Irving had left, I'll screw it up, but it's, he left Frontline to run MCA, the right. Worldwide. And he, you know, he ran MCA. Something happened. He left MCA. He had Giant Records. And then they decided through the years to, I think Irving might have, he was still managing the Eagles and whatever else, but signed Christina. And somewhere in there, he and Howard decided to put Frontline back together, get the band back together. And Irving called me and told me, this is what we're doing. And we'd love for you to come in with us. And I was flattered, but I also had just come from having a partner. So it wasn't, you know, the big thing on my mind of, I mean, to be honest with you, I was happy Irving knew who I was. Okay, that was enough for me. Okay, the guy, the biggest manager, baddest ass manager in the world knows my name. I'm pretty good right now. But we talked and Irving, you know, was very convincing. And, you know, it's flattering to talk to Irving. And he's a genuinely good man. And but I said something to him one day. I said, I don't know if I need you. I said, you know, here in Nashville, when an artist becomes available, I'm going to get the phone call. That's me being cocky. And he said,
do you say that to try to leverage yourself thinking I'm going to do this, but I want to make myself more valuable? Or are you genuinely on the fence of maybe you don't know what you're going to do?
I'm genuinely on the fence. And do I think I'm going to out negotiate Irving. Okay. So that thought's not even in my head. I'm just going, it's more of, I really don't want a partner, and how do I get out of this?
Yeah. Right.
You know, so here I'm gonna, I don't think I need you here in Nashville. I'm not signing acts in Los Angeles and London and New York. I'm staying out of the pop world. I mean, when you hear my accents, I'm not going to be that guy in Los Angeles, right? I know that. So
what does he say to you?
He says, I can hear you now. Irving's so fucking busy. Irving, you know, it's got this. Irving's got this. And I'm kind of chuckling. And he goes, but here's the difference, Clarence. When I come to Nashville, everybody knows who I am. And he says, when you come to Los Angeles, not a fucking soul knows who you are. And I tell this story and I always say, I should have been pissed, right? I should have been going, you know, you just smacked me down, which he did. Yeah,
fuck you, man.
But he smacked me down in such an honest way that it was totally true. And I knew it was true. When Irving Azar, people in this town will act like they know Irving. They've never met him. They'll say things about Irving, and I'm like, what? It's like a badge of courage, a badge of honor to have met Irving. And if you can drop Irving's name in a conversation, somebody who doesn't know him, you know, that's like, obviously I've been in the room with Irving Azoff. He was totally right about when I went to LA, when I went to New York, I had a few people who knew who I was, but they really didn't know. They'd never heard of me. Not that I know everybody. So it kind of was one of those cold glass of water to the face of going, okay, maybe you need to think about this differently. Maybe you need to think about it in not how I can remain a big manager in Nashville, but how I can become a better manager to my clients by expanding my base of people that I'm doing business with. And so, you know, thought about it, ended up doing the deal. It was a fantastic deal for me. It was on every level. It was for me a home run. And Irving introduced me to so many people that I still do business with. We're still friends. And it just, you know, he ended up selling the business to Live Nation. And that's, you know, we would have still been partners. And it was great. It was fantastic. And so, it's just funny to do things with Irving.
That's the, when I think of Irving, I always think of like tenacity. And I also think of how he has a way of making everything seem very simple. He even said in the Rock Hall of Fame induction when a couple weeks ago, he was like, this was easy. This made all the sense of the world to me. I said, of course I'm going to do this and I'll take over. Like he said, he knew that. Does any of that rub off on you, or does any of that like?
Well, I think yes. It rubs off on you in a way. There are certain people, and I think this comes from what I was just talking about, is, you know, I had to be smacked really to wake up and go, hey, you know, you can be a lot better manager than you are. Don't be so damn cocky because you got lucky. You know, you're lucky the first time, right? I'm lucky. I work my ass off. I'm running nightclubs and I'm on the road with Exile and I end up with Stan and I'm working really, really, really hard. And then I get lucky and I get in this Brooks and Dunn thing. And that when you get with a really hot act, for some reason, people think you're a lot smarter than you are. Okay. I mean, that's the truth. That's people think, oh, fuck, he must be brilliant, Brooks and Dunn. All of a sudden, the act comes out of it. Like Ronnie and Kix, who wrote all these hit songs, who are performing, Clarence must be a genius. He ain't a fucking genius. He's got a great grip. He hung his ass on for 25 years, right? First time, you're lucky. Second time, I got to give myself a little credit. Third time, I'm going to give myself a little credit, right? But that first time, you're just lucky. If you can take that luck and expand your horizons a little bit, even if you got to be smacked upside the head by Irving to do it, then you find yourself in places where you know Irving, and you know Michael Rapino, and you know Guile Cery, and you know all these great businessmen, entrepreneurs, managers, and 98% of them, when you're in the room with them or on the phone with them, when you get off the phone, you've got a lift. It's like you have done some kind of magical drug that just everything becomes possible because you've talked to these guys, and they think everything is possible. So why shouldn't it be possible? And you take that energy and use it to become a better manager, a better businessman, and a lot of times just a better person, of just knowing that, hey, you pick up the phone, you need a little juice, pick up the phone and call Irving. He doesn't even know he's dispensing it, but it's coming out of him, at every end.
He does have that effect. You know, I used to intern for Irving, and I would sit right outside of his office, and he would walk by every day and he'd give me a nod or a fist bump or just something very small. And even in that minor gesture, I would have a similar feeling of a lift or something. He's got a star power to him that's very contagious and very.
Yes, and, you know, he's able to back it up, and you know his Rolodex and his circle of people that he does business with or has done business with is so expansive. So when it comes time to do something, he's gonna get them on the phone. I used to go to lunch or dinner with him when he would come to town or I was out there, and he carries two phones and they're fucking ringing all the time and he's picking them up, and which is maddening to the person sitting there with him. But when you're sitting in Nashville, make that phone call, he picks right up. And then you're going, God, I'm glad he's got two phones, and I hope somebody out there is really fucking pissed that he took my phone call. He's been one of those guys. I look at Stan Maras, you know, gave me a real chance, and Jim Morey prior to him, who was my mentor when I was tour managing and doing all that. And then, you know, the Irvings come into your life, and, you know, Guy, and, you know, that whole group of people. So it's it's been interesting.
Absolutely. So I know we're running out of time, but I really want to ask, when you're putting together the Vegas residency for Brooks and Dunn, you call Larry Rudolph at Maverick just because he lives in Vegas and he's done this, and you just wanted to ask his advice. And what does he tell you about putting together a Vegas residency, or what's the best way to do it?
Well, I think what Larry did was gave me particular things to look for and ask for that if you hadn't done a Vegas residency prior, you wouldn't think about it. So that was very helpful. The idea of, you know, our show, that was at the time, Narvel Blackstock was Reba's manager and husband. We'd been best friends for 30 years. I mean, we met when he was playing steel with Reba. We sold T-shirts together. I mean, we go back. So we had done, and I don't know the year of this act, when we first did a Brooks and Dunn Reba tour, we did it 2 years in a row. And that was the first year we had 22 trucks, and we carried our own generators because some of the places we were playing, we were afraid didn't have enough power to do everything. And that tour was just, you know, so successful. And but you know, when you're putting those things together, it's just a tremendous amount of money, and the money makes pressure, you know. Money, you're going, we're putting this out and we've got flying shit up in the air, and we got people on, you know, Reba and Kix and Ronnie Wood, you never saw them come to the stage. They were on a sled that went underneath the stage. And so they would lie down and somebody would slide them, and they would go the length of the arena floor to a place and they would unload off and get in something else and go up in the air. And so, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of moving parts and a lot of really, really smart people doing all of that stuff. And it just, you know, it's fun and it's exciting and it's, you know, it's what you dream about as a young manager is, God, I hope I have something someday that's big. I hope I have something someday that is able to go out and tour. And we just, you know, Kix and Ronnie and I, we're just basically fucking carnies anyway. So anything that was goofy, you know, we would try. You know,
shooting out of a cannon or
oh my God, we, you know, shooting shit out of cannons, and then it was, we had inflatables, and you know, we had stuff that people just kind of cocked their head and went, really? And but it was so fun. It was just so damn fun for everybody to come to a Brooks and Dunn show. That, you know, it's part of it. But you know, I always remind people when we talk about this part, this side of it, the carny side of it. You don't get to know about that unless they're writing great songs. Unless, you know, Ronnie Dunn is one of the greatest singers of all time. None of that. You don't get any of that. Nobody's going to go out and see us blow inflatables out of a cannon and just to go see it. They want to hear Brand New Man and Neon Moon and Red Dirt Road. They want to hear those big songs. And some of them are willing to come along for the ride with us on all the other stupid shit we do. So the greatest thing about when we talk about Maverick and my friendship with Larry and Adam, and you know, there's all these guys, Scott Richards, and you know, it's just there were worlds that I wasn't involved in, right? I mean, the urban world, the Paul McCartney, you know, Bocelli, it's Madonna, it's who. I think the genius of the whole idea is that we always had somebody to call. So there was somebody within Maverick that had an expertise in some other area that we had none. So when they came, you know, when Steven Tyler came to town to do his country album, call Clarence. Call Clarence and see what he thinks. So that to know that you had somebody to back you up, once again, a little bit of cold water in the face to go, hey, you want to tour Europe and you want to tour it the right way? Pick up the phone and call so-and-so. They just did this around the world, you know? So that's where the Adams and those guys came in handy about, not, you know, it was never this epiphany thing. It's always the little gentle reminders of, don't forget this. This will hang you up at the border for a week. Here's my contact at the border. Make sure you call them and let them know you're coming through. They're going to make it a lot easier than you just showing up there with 20 trucks.
Right.
So those are the you know, and I think that's part of that's, you know, the relationships, part of it is the experience and, you know, and allowing your ego to get out of the way and go, you know, you don't know everything. And, you know, feel free to pick up the phone and call me, or for me to pick up the phone and call Adam or Larry or, you know, whoever that was to go, hey, you've done this before. I just read you did this. Or, you know, when we came out of Maverick meetings, it was, you went around the room talking about what was going on with different acts and different situations. So you got to, you know, behind the curtains, look at, you know, what we all found out was we all have the same problems. They just have a different face on them.
Right.
So it's interesting. So
have we left anything out? Is there anything that we haven't said yet?
No, because you know more than I know. So I'm just trying to think, is there anything?
Are Flats going to play the road one last time, or is the tour going to be rescheduled?
I don't know that. I do think that COVID threw a monkey wrench into a farewell tour. And what I sense from the guys is right now they would have been finished with the farewell tour and moving on to the next thing. But with COVID, what they've done is they moved on to the next things earlier. So, you know, this one's doing a gospel. Jay's got this going on. Joe Don's got this going on. So they've had the time to just focus on whatever else they wanted to do. I'll get the sense that next year they're going to start looking around going, what are we going to do now? What are we going to do now? So I look to, I'd be surprised in 22 if they don't go back out, whether that ends up being a farewell tour now that they've already, they're going to have 2.5 years of never seeing a soul performing. And, you know, I think when I talk to people that shut it down, I mean, Kix and Ronnie, when they shut it down, I would be willing to bet you they'd say the thing they missed most was the performing. You know, not very many jobs do you go out and get instant gratification on. I sang a song and 15,000 people stood up and cheered me for that. I mean,
right.
That's heady stuff. I don't care who you are. And I think that's the part that they, you know, the money, they've all made money. But I think that part of it, the connection with the fan base and being able to go out and, you know, sing those songs that they've been, you know, made big old hits. I think that's something. So we'll see. You know, the COVID has been a just one of those things in life. You know, somebody called me yesterday and I think because I'm 60 some years old, I should know everything. And I don't know a lot. And this COVID thing, I don't know. You know, I don't know when we're going to go back. And I got a feeling of this could be the earliest we go back. And I said to them, I said, you know, I have in all the years of doing this, I've bus wrecks and mass shootings and, you know, you name it, divorces and births of babies and, you know, all the things that go into life and some extras. I've been through that, but this thing, this is a whole different level of affecting people on different levels. You know, that's, you have the younger managers and agents and acts, and this was going to be a great year for them. This was going to be the year where some of them got to ring the bell. You know, this was going to be,
right.
we've struggled, and 2020 is going to be the year we make a bunch of money, right? And it didn't happen. Not only did they not make a bunch of money, they had to let people go. And some of those people will never come back to this business. They're going to go out and find something else. And they're going to go, this is a lot better. I mean, I have two or three within some of my organizations that they're like, nah, I've had enough. I'm out. I'm moving back to wherever. And I've got a steady job that has insurance and I don't have to be gone all the time. And, you know, life happens. And you just, I mean, in the beginning of my career, tell me when you need to quit.
I've got all the time in the world. I'm on your time, Clarence.
Obviously, I don't have shit going on because I'm sitting here yapping all day. But you know, in the beginning of my career, I struggled with that. You know, I was on the road and with Exile, and it just didn't seem like it was going anywhere. We were working massive amounts of dates, not because they wanted to, because they had to. I mean, it was five of them. Whatever the money was, net it down and divide it by five. It wasn't, you know, they weren't making retirement money.
Right.
So, you know, you get on that bus week after week after week, and in the beginning, it's fun. Nothing like it. You're out there with your buddies, you party every night, and you're traveling the world, and you're seeing things you've never seen before. Second year, not so much. In the third year, the bus becomes more like a prison. And when you asked me in the beginning, do you still go out on the road? And I go, yeah, but I don't enjoy it. I love going out. Getting from A to B is what I hate. So once I get out there, I'm great. I can sit around catering on the bus. I've done it for so many years. I know the flow. I know how the day goes. I don't even, I could close my eyes right now. And if my tours are out on the road, I could tell you right now exactly what's going on out there. I can just tell you they're playing, crew's playing pickleball. This is going on inside. First act is sound checking. You know, we're getting ready to do this. 5 o'clock, we're going to have dinner, blah, 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 blah. But the idea of, you know, jumping on the bus and riding 300 or 400 miles doesn't excite me at all. You know,
the destination. In this case, the destination is what counts, not the journey.
Yeah, and I really don't give a shit what the destination is. I mean, it can be Gearing, Nebraska, or you know, wherever. I love. I played with Exile. There's not a state we didn't go to. Probably 90% of the provinces of Canada we went to, because they had been a pop act. We toured Europe and England.
Right.
So yeah. I got to go all over the place with them. And, you know, when you do that, you find yourself, there's something interesting everywhere you go. It might not be a sight, but it's probably more the people. So you're standing backstage talking to Joe, security guy, or Bob, who's on the fare board, and all of a sudden, you know, you find out that they're the most interesting people you've met in months and months by where they came from, you know, moved here from wherever and started doing this. And it's just people are interesting, and some people tend to want to sit on the bus all day and do nothing. And me, that drives me crazy. So I got to wander around and see, and you know, nobody knows who I am. So I'm just some old fucker out there wandering around. So it becomes a lot more interesting that way. So.
Do you work with Breland also? Or I saw Breland was on the Maverick site. Is that you, or is that Big Loud, or?
Well, I don't know. Breland, I know that name, but I don't know who has them. So sometimes when you go to a Maverick meeting, you
hear about
three acts are gone and four acts have come in. You know, it's like, oh, I didn't know we lost them. Oh yeah, you know, in the urban world, it's a little bit more fluid, I think, than in my world. I mean, you know, I not that I haven't lost acts, but it's rarely am I, you know, losing somebody. So
fair enough. Clarence, one of the busiest guys in town, thanks for taking the time today. So appreciate it. When I first moved to town, I think you were like one of the first or second meetings that I ever had. I think I sat in that office and we talked for about an hour or whatever it was.
That was
such a cool feeling, and thanks for taking the time right now.
Well, thank you, and I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Stay well, and hope we get a chance to see a show or somewhere soon.
There you have it. Clarence Spaulding on the podcast. It was so cool to talk with someone like him who just manages some of the biggest acts in the world. And I like how he said that if your act's not going to make a moment or make a splash, maybe don't play the award show. I mean, I don't know how you turn down a spot at the CMAs, but I mean, that's management right there. By the way, if you're on this kind of management kick, you want to listen to a couple other episodes with managers. We did a great episode with Chris Cappy, who manages Luke Combs. Check that one out. And we have we interviewed Ralph Jacquedine as well, who's professor of music management at Berklee College of Music, and he had some great wisdom to offer as well. So check out some earlier episodes. Clarence, thanks for coming on the show. That was such a thrill. So much fun to talk with you, and so grateful that you took the time. Really appreciate it. Hope we get the chance to talk again soon. Thank you all for listening. And that's it. That's all I'm going to say. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. Subscribe to our newsletter, nationalbriefing.com. You can follow us on socials, everything at National Briefing. Follow me on Instagram if you want to. Zach Kuhn Official. That's it. I've said too much here. I got to go. We'll see you next time. Bye.